Wire.com.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. If Ken Burns' 19 hours of PBS Jazz opened your mind to the music, you're ready this hour to take it up a notch and fill in some of the blanks with the nonpareil writer on the subject, Whitney Balliot. It's often remarked that Whitney Balliot's jazz pieces in the New Yorker magazine somehow reproduce the sound of jazz in describing the indescribable. In fact, he's very like a jazz soloist himself. Think of Miles in this solo on Walkin'. Whitney Balliot, too, is a one-off individualist who's unpredictable and often unfashionable, sometimes effusive, other times impossibly hard to please. Like the best jazz players who never play the tune the same way twice, Balliot avoids familiar routes through the territory, but even when he's cranky, his voice sounds smitten with the mystery and magic of this music. Listeners, if Ken Burns was Jazz 101, Whitney Balliot is the start of graduate school. His own first jazz piece was a review of the Duke Ellington Orchestra on the Cornell campus more than 50 years ago. He's been listening astutely and fussily ever since. Give him a call at 1-800-423-8255. He's written about Armstrong and Ellington, of course, but also Pee Wee Russell, Mabel Mercer, Ornette Coleman are the stars of Whitney Balliot's collected works, A Journal of Jazz, 1954 to the year 2000, 850 pages. He writes about the underlying aesthetic. He writes about the future of jazz. Give him a call, 1-800-423-TALK. You can join us online at theconnection.org. Whitney Balliot, it's a pleasure to have you on The Connection. I mean, just listening to Miles, I want to ask you, above all, what defines the good stuff for you?
It's largely emotion. It's you hear something and it just it moves you. It can be a phrase that lasts one measure, or it can be a whole tune. It's a kind of a secret thing. It may not move somebody else, but it gets you, and that's as long as those things continue happening in the music, as long as the music affects you that way, it will survive.
Hmm. I'm wondering what that mystery is. I mean, you've been writing about it forever. You've opened it to a lot of people. Your prose, as I say, kind of is touched with the same thing. Do we know?
I mean, you're talking about the secrets or what?
Yeah, well, whatever it is that connects connects all these pieces, and I guess our feeling about them, the Olympian lineage at the top of jazz that you write about, Jelly Roll Morton, Duke Ellington, Basie, Thelonious Monk, John Lewis, who's a particular favorite of yours. Those just happen to be composers and pianists. The drummers that you love, and we'll get to some of them. The bands.
Right. Well, it doesn't matter what the size of the group is or what period it is. I mean, you can hear Jelly Roll Morton sing the blues, and it gives you that special feeling. I mean, he was a wonderful singer. And you can hear, I remember, it used to be such a treat. I wasn't crazy about the last Basie bands because they were like huge machines. But but often when you went to hear them, Basie would play a slow blues, and he would start with Freddie Green on guitar and the bass and the drums. And he plays 6 or 8 choruses by himself, you know, just the way he did it. And it was fantastic. It's just one. It's such a treat.
I wish I had that queued up, and I don't. We'll maybe get to it. What I do have queued up, something I'm glad you love because I love it too, is the it was a Norman Grant session with the 3 great alto saxophone players, Benny Carter, Johnny Hodges, and Charlie Parker, plus Oscar Peterson and Ben Webster and Charlie Shavers and a variety of others. But there's a particular pair of blues choruses by Charlie Parker following Johnny Hodges on a Hodges thing called Funky Blues, which they probably hadn't thought about for 3 seconds before they started playing. But I'd love people to hear it, and I'd love you to talk about it. This is Charlie Parker following 2 Hodges choruses on slow blues called Funky Blues. Benny Carter, but the Parker thing is astounding.
Oh, it's unbelievable. I mean, the beginning of the first chorus, where he preaches the first couple of measures, you know, before he gets going, and then that in the beginning of the second chorus, that incredible run. It just, no, that's full of secrets.
that is
run,
the secret.
That run.
Well, there's
right
also
there.
That big, broad sound, which very few alto players get out of the instrument.
Yeah.
To me, that thing is so full of drama because it's Charlie Parker, who'd already been the superstar, following the man he learned the blues from, really, Johnny Hodges, who he'd eclipsed with a whole new style. But to me, there's such love in that testament.
Yeah. And, of course, it wasn't used in the Ken Burns thing, which is unbelievable.
No. Well, maybe they didn't have pictures. There is one picture of that assemblage in Hollywood.
Right.
Barney Kessel and...
And Parker looking rather... Well, he was dead 2 years later, so... I think. You know, it was 1953.
Yeah, well, we'll come back to things that Ken Burns left out. That's sort of another whole question. What did Parker do for the aesthetic and the mystery and the whole story, in your experience?
Well, he invented a new music. I mean, if you go and if you listen to those 2 takes of Embraceable You, I guess it is, he doesn't play any of the melody ever. It's just a whole new invention, you know, from the first note to the last. It's almost like a new kind of music. I mean, that's when he was really on. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I don't think anybody has ever succeeded him, really. His originality and his the emotion.
Phil Wood says we'll be studying him 100 years from now, trying to unfurl all that was in that music.
I know. But unfortunately, I mean, Coltrane took over not long afterward, and everybody began to follow him. I mean, they were all in Coltrane's wake, and the whole tone of the instrument changed. It became hard. And, you know, the Websters and Hawkins and Parker, and to my way of thinking, they used the instrument properly, the right way. And all these hard-toned people, and they're still doing it. I mean, all the kids are still doing it, you know. They should all go back and listen to Ben Webster and Hawkins. And
we're going to listen to some Ben Webster and Hawkins after the break. Before the break, though, I want you to talk something about drummers and about Big Sid Catlett in particular. You're a drummer yourself, and you write so lovingly about so many drummers over the years, a lot of ones that we don't all know. I'd never heard of Specs Wright, but we've all heard of Joe Jones and Philly Joe Jones, Buddy Rich, Sonny Greer, Max Roach, Art Blakey. But I take it Big Sid Catlett is your man for the ages.
No question about it. And people like Philly Joe Jones and Art Blakey and everything, they all learned from Catlett when they were young. And I think there's no question he was the greatest drummer who ever lived. I mean, he had taste, he had an infallible beat, and he could move around in the beat. If he wanted to push somebody, he'd move up to the front of the beat. And he wanted to lay back, he'd move to the back of the beat. But he was always lifting whoever he was playing behind.
What we're listening to in the background is Sid Catlett with Louis Armstrong and All Stars at Symphony Hall in Boston in 1947, I think. One of the striking things is how soft he plays.
Yeah, well, and melodically. The sounds that come out of his solos, so many different timbres.
You've played this for younger drummers. I know you've written about playing this for the marvelous young drummer Leon Parker. What were you wanting Leon Parker, say, to hear in this boff boff solo?
Everything. And what he did here, I don't know. His reaction was very mysterious. I mean, he looked pleased, and he had Catlett mixed up with Baby Dawes. I mean, he had no idea who he was.
Probably not after he heard him. We're talking about jazz with the premier writer on the subject, Whitney Balliot of the New Yorker magazine, on the occasion of his collected works. We'll be back. This is The Connection from NPR.
You're listening to WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, NPR news stations. Coming up in the second hour.
Talk about some of the people that got left out of the Ken Burns jazz series. This is Errol Garner from the Concert by the Sea, a song called Red Top, which he makes completely new. What about Errol Garner, Whitney Balliot?
He was extraordinary. He was one of the great originals. He never could read music, but he could play any pianist style. You know, if you asked him to play Earl Hines or Tommy Flanagan, he could do it. And it was just extraordinary that he was left out, because he was one of the true inventions, one of the true originals.
The line was that he didn't influence enough people, and yet every pianist ever since has cultivated Errol Licks and dreamed of that sound.
Yes.
That orchestral Chopin sound, I think.
Yeah. I mean, Jimmy Rolls, who was a great pianist himself, I mean, you always hear a little Garner in there, and he, you know, he admired him enormously.
I mean, it's one of the things about him that music doesn't age a day from 1955 or whenever it was.
No.
Yeah. Pop goes the weasel, pop goes the Errol.
Yeah.
Again, you know, when you're judging, and you do judge them, all these extraordinarily one-off souls, how would you have argued to Ken Burns, of course he's got to be in there.
Mm. Well, I mean, the whole program was run by the so-called Holy Trinity of Wynton Marsalis, Andy Crouch, and Al Murray. And their feelings about the music color the entire program, and I suppose they didn't feel that Garner was up to snuff, which is absurd.
You mentioned, I mean, you're talking about Al Murray, Stanley Crouch, and Wynton Marsalis, sort of grandfather, son, and grandson in a kind of intellectual lineage. But again, they're classicists. But you know. What is you wonder, what is the judgment there? Duke Ellington, with his orchestra, Basin Street East, I believe it was. But Errol came in to listen, and Duke said, "Now a real pianist has just entered the room, and would he play?" And he did. I wonder, where do you draw the lines here, and how could, especially in the service of Duke Ellington, how do you exclude geniuses?
I know, because, I mean, Ellington was a fantastic pianist. You know, he never got the credit that was due him as a piano player, but listening to him behind that band, he played things that were so far out sometimes, it's a wonder the soloist that he was backing didn't fall off the stage.
I want you to talk a little bit about others that got left out of the PBS series. Charles Mingus, for example, got very short shrift, but maybe, I mean, some people think he's second only to Ellington in his creation of new tunes.
That's true. Ellington was a tremendous influence on him, but then he moved off in a different direction there. I mean, when in the 60s, when he had those various small bands, I mean, he did all kinds of things, experimenting with improvised ensembles. And, you know, and playing with almost a ferocity. And, you know, well, he was in some ways a ferocious man, but...
Let's listen to Charles Mingus from the Mingus A.M. Album, something called Better Get It In Your Soul. Where does that belong in the history of the music?
Right near the top. No, that's full of secrets, just that little part you played. Jimmy Nepper was playing the trombone there, and he's totally left out of the show. You know, he's, to my way of thinking, the greatest modern trombonist. But you hear Mingus, you know, shouting in the background and carrying on. And, I mean, he just pushed every performance with his bass and his voice and his, you know. He didn't like the way somebody was playing, he'd fire him right then and there.
On the bandstand, right?
Yeah.
There's so many other categories of, well, it's impossible in any series to touch them all, but there's one in particular I'd like to hear and I'd like you to talk about. I guess you say in the new book that the first profile you ever wrote for the New Yorker magazine and for Mr. Sean was of Pee Wee Russell.
Mm-hmm.
I used to hear Pee Wee Russell at Eddie Condon's in the 60s. You describe his face as sort of the most developed face that you ever saw. It made John L. Lewis, the old labor leader, look like a beginner, a baby. But I'd like to play just a little fragment of a blues for Pee Wee with his own clarinet sound, and I'd love you to talk about him. What sort of a man was Pee Wee Russell?
He was very mysterious. I mean, he didn't talk a great deal, and he was very nervous all the time. And of course, that comes out in his playing. You know, in some ways, some of his solos are just a string of nerves, you know, put together. But again, he was another, like Garner, another fantastic original. I mean, some of his solo, no clarinetist ever played that way. I mean, some people used to laugh at him because they said he couldn't play the clarinet, but that's ridiculous.
The way Thelonious Monk couldn't play the piano.
Yeah, exactly.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Whitney Balliet connection with the New Yorker magazine jazz critic and profile writer for more than 40 years. 1-800-423-TALK. Bill is on the line.
Morning, Chris and Whitty.
Good morning, Bill.
Listen, gentlemen, you know, I guess this whole jazz program put on by Ken Burns is going to be dissected for years to come with his shortcomings, but I found it quite interesting. I thought it was sufficient. I thought it was okay. But what I want to talk about is a segment of jazz that always gets left out of jazz formats, and they are the dashing, debonair male vocalists of jazz, people like Arthur Prysock, Johnny Hartman, Billy Eckstein, to a lesser degree, Joe Williams. Nat King Cole, when he was coming up, had a hell of a time breaking in. When he broke into television, for instance, the racism was overwhelming. I wonder, Whitney, now, is that what held back the jazz vocalists, the males, from entering upon center stage? Was the racism that much of a factor? Is it still overlasting? Why don't the vocalists get their due?
That's a good question, but I mean, the whole vocal thing was so dominated by people like Frank Sinatra. Johnny Hartman was a wonderful singer. I used to go and hear him when he was still around New York. Joe Williams, I always found Joe Williams a little bit slick. I don't know. I mean, he was a great admirer of Joe Turner's. who I think was the greatest blues singer. But I don't know why. I don't know whether it was purely racial. That's a good question. I just don't know.
Do you want to add a few to Bill's list of approved? I'm just doing a terrible block right now on Duke Ellington's singer in the 40s, whom I love. Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me, but it'll come to me.
Anyway. I can't think of his name.
Well, there are so many good ones. And Bill, you named a lot of them. Big Joe Turner, we'll come back to perhaps. I mean, he's a favorite of Whitney Balliot's. And there are lots more. 1-800-423-TALK is our phone. Al is calling from Essex, New York.
Hi.
Morning, Al.
How are you today?
Good.
I wanted to ask something. I would like to say that I'm grateful to the Byrne Show, just that it introduces a lot of people to it. You know, you have to give it credit for that. At least I feel you do. There are a lot of, you know, you could have taken 2,000 hours. The other thing is, I'd like to hear Mr. Balliot's comment on the difference between Miles and Clifford Brown.
I think Clifford Brown was a much better trumpet player. He had, you know, great eloquence and could play with speed. I mean, it was just a shame that he disappeared at such an early time in that automobile accident. But I think he would have changed things a great deal if he'd still been around.
Al, thank you. I mean, there's so many that died young and that sort of one misses. Charlie Parker, perhaps preeminent. But who else do you think of that sort of the great unfinished talents?
Well, I mean, Billie Holiday was 44 when she died. Classic case, of course, of Dick Spiderbeck, who was, what, 28? Yeah. Big Sid was 41.
I was astonished to read that.
You know? Well, he had a bad heart, and he never took care of him, so.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Jazz Connection with Whitney Balliot. Ray is calling from Iowa City, Iowa.
Good morning.
Morning, Ray.
I have a question and a comment. My question is, and I guess I can't really form this into a question per se, but I'd like your guest to address the issue of humor in jazz. You know, just hearing that quote a little bit back of Pop Goes the Weasel, it just brought to mind the fact that, you know, one of the things I love about jazz is that it's one of the few forms of popular music that regularly utilizes humor. You know, rock and roll sort of has that sort of, you know, adolescent self-seriousness, you know, that can become so overbearing, you know. And I just think humor is an important part of jazz. And my comment is that I don't want to blow my own horn or give myself a plug, but I just got done, I'm getting finished doing research and writing a chapter on black music and musicians in Iowa for a history of blacks in Iowa. And one of the things I've discovered is that, you know, wherever you go, there's probably jazz being made. And I would hope that people would come away from Ken Burns' series and go out and find the music that's being made right now by musicians today, you know, because there's some great music out there.
Ray, it's a good point, and we're going to talk about it before this hour is up. I mean, it goes on, and I think Whitney Balliot is among the believers maybe more than Ken Burns and Wynton Marsalis in the future of the music. But before the break, I want to get into at least one other of the neglected stars, and that's Ben Webster, who sort of emerged in the Ellington Band in the late 30s and then had a troubled but brilliant career as a ballad player and a lyrical tenor saxophone player in his own right with small bands. Talk a little bit about Ben.
Well, Ben was a very competent tenor player in the Coleman Hawkins, I'm sorry, mold. But then he joined Ellington in the late 30s and sitting next to Johnny Hodges did it. It just influenced his whole style, and he became warmer and more melodic, and he was often an angry man, and but that disappeared from his playing. You could hear it in the 30s, but Hodges just taught him, you know, everything. It's just extraordinary. And then he rose up, and in my way of thinking, he became an equal of Lester Young and Hawkins.
This is Ben Webster and Johnny Hodges playing together in the late 50s. It's a tune, again, they probably made up very quickly, called Big Ears. Ben Webster was quoted, though, saying he, you know, what he wanted in life was to do on the tenor saxophone what Johnny Hodges did on the mm-hmm. alto. And some people think he outdid his master.
Mm-hmm.
Who's to say? This is Webster and Hodges together on something called Big Ears. We're talking about jazz with Whitney Balliot of the New Yorker magazine. He's just published his collected works, A Journal of Jazz, from 1954 to 2000. We'll be back after a short break. The phone is 1-800-423-8255. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the second hour of The Connection with Christopher Lydon, soundsculptures.com.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Whitney Balliot Jazz Connection. Tune by Harold Arlen, played by a new and young pianist named Bill Charlap. He's a favorite of Whitney Balliot's, and he's a piece of that magic and mystery into the future. I wish you'd tell us about Bill Charlap. I didn't know about him until I read him in your book and in The New Yorker.
He's in his early 30s. His father was Moose Charlap, and he wrote for Broadway. So Bill grew up in New York City, and he grew up in a house. His mother was a singer. He grew up in a house full of songs, constantly songs. So he, as a result, he knows hundreds of songs. I mean, he has a thorough knowledge of all the great songs that were written in the 20s, 30s, and the 40s. He studied classical piano for a while, but that didn't work because he kept improvising when he should have been playing straight. And then slowly drifted over to jazz. He has a phenomenal technique, but the technique doesn't rule him the way it has ruled other pianists. And he just gets inside all the songs he plays. I mean, in the slow one like we're hearing. And even when he goes up tempo where he loves to play, it's just, brilliant. He's a brilliant piano player. You know, it's as good as anybody that has ever come along, I think.
But he studies his Bill Evans, too, I think.
Yes, yes. And he knows everybody. He knows studied every piano player. And there's a lot of Jimmy Rolls in his playing, which is wonderful because Rolls is one of the great original players that more piano players should study. You know, not enough people know about him. But you can hear, you know, you can hear Rolls and Charlap all the time.
Let's keep listening. But to callers also, 1-800-423-8255 makes the jazz connection with Whitney Balliott. Forrest is calling from Edgemont, South Dakota. Hello, Forrest.
Hello.
Hello, Forrest. Welcome.
Yes, I'd like to ask the guest a question.
Please.
My name is Bruce from Columbia, South Carolina.
Okay, Bruce.
And I'd like to ask, what is the guest opinion of the Dave Brubeck Quartet of the 50s and 60s as individual musicians, Joe Morello on drums, and what effect, if any, have they had on jazz?
Okay. Whitney Ballard, you've revised your opinion, especially of Paul Desmond, and in the Brubeck history. Where do you place all that?
Desmond was a brilliant alto player. I mean, full of humor, and there are vague traces of Lester Young in there, but he was totally original. And he gave that whole group its melodic beauty and lift, and of course the drummer was terrific too. I've never been a tremendous admirer of Brubeck's, but he kept everything going, and his Wagner touches and things like that.
More Wagner than Bach. They sold it as Bach.
Yeah. I don't know how much influence the Brubeck group had. You know, I remember, excuse me, going up to the first Newport Jazz Festival in 1954 with George Avakian, who was then working for Columbia Records. And he was trying to decide whether to sign up the Modern Jazz Quartet or Dave Brubeck. And what happened to Chris Wythe? He signed up Dave Brubeck. And Brubeck became immensely popular, you know, for years and years and years.
Jazz goes to college and all that stuff.
Right.
Should jazz go to college? That's the question. 1-800-423-8255. Bruce, thank you. Bob is on the line.
Good morning, Chris.
Welcome, Bob.
Bob Ryan, how you doing?
Oh, the Bob Ryan.
Well, I don't know that, but
he's the Whitney Balliott of the Boston Globe sports page.
You know, I understand that Mr. Balliott's also already discussed a topic I wanted to ask about. I didn't hear the beginning, which was Sid Catlett, and maybe I don't want to be repetitive. I was just had been curious to know what was the source of his admiration for Sid Catlett as opposed to all other drummers and even musicians. I guess you've discussed it. It's funny, I first heard of Sid Catlett because his son, Sid Jr., was a very fine basketball player at Notre Dame. I don't know if you knew that, Chris.
I didn't.
He was. He was a scholarship player in the Austin Carr era, which will mean something to some of your listeners. But I just want to say this. It's an extreme honor and to be able to even be on the other end of a phone with Mr. Whitney Balliott, who, as a writer, I awesomely admire because of his ability to transmit sound. I can't think of nothing more difficult in writing than what he does to make a reader appreciate sound. I think of so many of his profiles, Ellis Larkin.
Amen.
That was one of my favorites, and it made me want to go and catch Ellis Larkin, who I guess is, I don't even know if he's still alive, but...
He is.
Just to say, Mr. Balliott, how much I just admire that incredible ability as a writer and how much pleasure you brought me as a jazz fan over the years. And I'm sorry I missed your discourse on Sid Catlett, but because I'm a big Buddy Rich fan, I just can't imagine who how he could be better. But because you say he was better, I've always been willing to believe, well, I guess Sid Catlett was better.
Bob Ryan, I'm so glad you mentioned Ellis Larkins, because he's the perfect type of the musician that Whitney Ballard has introduced us to over the years. I mean, I think of Ellis Larkins and Ruby Braff playing Liza, but playing in those little clubs on the East Side with 30 people.
I saw him at the Carnegie Tavern, and the late lamented Carnegie Tavern years ago.
Yes.
He was quite late, but he was quite worth waiting for.
And every set would last about 20 minutes.
That's
Do you remember
it.
That?
That's it.
And then you get off the stand and go and have some brandy and come back and play another 20 minutes.
Precisely. But that's all. I someday maybe we'll meet and I can really pepper you with Sid Catlett questions. But just an honor to be able to talk with you.
Bob Ryan, thank you.
Bye-bye.
The Larry Bird of Sports Pros. Bob, thank you. 1-800-423-TALK. John is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, John.
Hello, I'm calling from deepest Natick, and wanted to thank Mr. Balliot for his writing all these years, too. And I'm an Ellis Larkins fan from the early Ella Fitzgerald collaborations, in which I first heard him, and he was just had a pearly kind of sound, using some of Mr. Balliot's verbiage. But one of the things I wanted to ask is about the Ken Burns show and whether it was centered on race, which I think is right from a historical viewpoint. But there were some wonderful white players, and one of them who died young was Eddie Costa, a wonderful pianist. And I wondered if Mr. Balliot had heard much of him. I'm sure he did hear him, but he disappeared so fast.
Well, let's hear. I didn't hear it myself. John, thank you.
Yes, I used to listen to Costa every chance I got. He had the most. He loved to play down in the lower registers. He had an extraordinary left hand. And, of course, he, too, was killed in an automobile accident in his 20s. That was a great loss.
Eddie Costa, 1-800-423-8255, joins the conversation. Lee is calling from Williamsburg, Virginia.
I was interested in your evaluation of Eric Dolphy, somebody who left early. Are you familiar with him?
Yes, yes. I used to hear him with Mingus.
Yes, exactly. Well, he was an Army buddy, but a phenomenal player.
Yes, he was.
Who's not mentioned very much anymore.
I know, that's true.
But was hugely influential. Why?
I don't know how influential he was. Do you really think?
Well, I hear, you know, the players still speak about him with awe.
Yeah. No, he was another. I mean, he was totally original. He kind of balanced Ornette Coleman. You know, when Coleman came up.
Yes.
And those things that he made with Mingus, where they just the two of them played together. And they were having conversations. This is what they said. They were talking to each other on their instruments, and they're just amazing duets. Mm. You know? And, of course, he died very young. I don't know. You know.
Lee, thank you. 1-800-423-TALK. Sarah is on the line.
Hello?
Hello, Sarah. Welcome.
I would like to contribute to the program.
Please.
Is there time left?
Yes, indeed. Go for it.
Oh, thank you. I didn't realize I was speaking with you. My name is Maxine. I'd like to applaud the program of jazz, and I've heard a bit of negative criticism. I think that the title of the program is A History of Jazz, and it's very difficult to feature all of the really, really great musicians that are jazz musicians. I thought in the program, this is my first time calling, so I'm nervous.
Don't be nervous, but come to the point. We're running out of time.
Okay. I thought that it dealt with the harmonic development. The program dealt with the harmonic development of jazz. And I've heard I've done some work with a Dr. David Baker, who is an eminent authority on jazz, and he gives this kind of breakdown that Louis Armstrong's contribution, and with the stretching and the development of the harmonic development with Lester Young, Charlie Parker, and Miles Davis, and I thought they followed that harmonic development very well. They could not feature everybody that excelled in each of those formats.
Maxine, fair point, but it does leave a question, and there's a lot of argument out there why, especially the musicians and people who've been listening for a long time, but very specifically the musicians, found that series visually stunning, promotionally a boon, but still unsatisfying. Can the question be answered without sounding sour grapes-ish or invidious?
Well, it seemed to me that the whole thing was out of balance because too much time was spent on Armstrong and Ellington and Davis. And the result was all these terrific people got left out because there wasn't any room left.
The moral, I suppose, is just to do it more and more and more, that 19 hours or whatever are just barely enough. We've also got to sort of leave room for the future. And in that way, I want to go out on something that you, again, have sort of introduced me to, and that's the tenor saxophone of Joe Lovano.
Yes.
Tell us just a little bit about Joe Lovano and this piece, Lament for M, written by Gunther Schuller.
Written by Gunther Schuller, you know, about his wife who had recently died, Marjorie. And
not a lot to say, and maybe we shouldn't. It's Joe Lovano playing Lament for M. Joe Lovano will be our guest on The Connection on Friday. For the moment, thank you, Whitney Balliot. His new collection of writings is called Collected Works, A Journal of Jazz from 1954 to 2000. You can continue the jazz conversation on our website at theconnection.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and by the Allaire Corporation.
Mm-hmm.